Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. Today's guest is Patrick Collison. Patrick is the co-founder of Stripe, and in addition to being one of the most impressive, is probably one of the most intellectually interesting CEOs today. This episode, we talk about Patrick's come-up story from Ireland, dropping out of college to start Stripe, then building and scaling his company internationally. Patrick shares advice for entrepreneurs. We talk about education, we talk about immigration, and then a bunch of other intellectual topics. If you enjoyed the Tyler Cowen or Ezra Klein episode, you will also enjoy this one. I had a great time chatting with Patrick, and hope you'll enjoy listening. All right, here's Patrick. Patrick, this is the Product Hunt podcast, the illustrious Maker Stories. Thank you for being on here today.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you? Where are you calling in from?
I am in the Mission in San Francisco, where both Stripe is based, and I also live.
Oh wow! I expected you to be in Ireland, but we're literally like 5 minutes away from each other.
Yeah, no, I left Ireland back when I was 17. I came out here to the US for school.
Cool, but you're not visiting for the holidays?
No, this is actually the first Christmas in which I have not gone back to Ireland. So I will be here in San Francisco for the whole thing.
Okay, and you have an interesting family story, having started the company with your brother, obviously. But first, I want to get into, when you talk about Stripe to people who are not in the tech scene, and who, you know, Stripe is obviously a huge company, but you know, many people outside the tech scene may not know what it is. How do you describe it?
So, unfortunately, the vast majority of people are sort of not really in our target market, in the sense that they're not developers, but luckily pretty much everyone these days has bought something on the internet, and not only have they bought things online, but they're also generally pretty familiar with sort of how our economy is changing as a result of all the new apps and services that are appearing on the scene, in that, you know, when you sort of think about the changes being driven by Uber and Lyft and Instacart and DoorDash and Postmates and sort of the whole app economy, and then sort of more broadly services like Kickstarter and OpenTable and sort of that endless list, there's kind of this big trend of services kind of making the leap from kind of just existing purely on the internet to actually helping us sort of more directly in the real world, sort of doing real tangible things in sort of our daily lives. And then sort of describing the need for sort of infrastructure behind that, be it AWS or app stores, or in our case, facilitating payments and commerce. And so that's how I normally describe it. We're the sort of the layer and the infrastructure behind the scenes that's powering the money movement for so much of this new technology shift and this new economy.
And you mentioned you moved from Ireland when you were 17. How did you come up with this idea? And you'll start it with your brother. What's the origin story for Stripe?
Yeah, so I'd been working on, I guess, various kinds of developer tools for a long time, in that I sort of had this wayward youth where I started programming PHP when I was 13, and then I discovered Lisp not long after that, and then spent a couple of years working on dialects and different versions of Lisp, and then worked for a while in a company that built everything in Smalltalk. And I was also kind of interested in weird operating systems like Genera and Plan 9 and all the stuff that really almost literally nobody still uses today. But I guess I was just really interested in sort of what made a good developer tool or service. And I guess maybe more broadly, just how developers can be made more productive and how that was coming to matter to an increasing extent. And a particular thing I remember was SliceHost first coming out. I bet for the vast majority of your listeners, sort of folks who have never heard of SliceHost, they were actually acquired by Rackspace back a couple of years ago. But SliceHost was basically the first really good kind of virtual hosting provider. And so this was back when EC2 was actually pretty awkward to set up. It required you to go through all this crap with Java command line, key pair, blah, blah, blah. With SliceHost, you could just create an account, put in your credit card number, to log into the web interface, click create server, and 20 seconds later, a root password would be emailed to you. And so it was sort of this incredible combination of sort of the control that you'd get if you had like a dedicated server somewhere, but kind of the ease of use of all these shared web hosting systems. And I remember when I first used SliceHost, it was just so obvious that like this was going to be the future. Like this is kind of how hosting should work. It was, again, this combination of so lightweight and yet you had so much control. And it was really striking then to both me and to John, where as we built these websites, we built these services, like we were sort of just like so many young developers kind of experimenting and toying with ideas, we kind of build these things, but we'd never charge for them because that always kind of seemed like too much work. And so we kind of wondered one day, why did we never charge for them? And we kind of realized it was basically because it just seemed so complicated. Like it felt like getting a mortgage or something like that. And so we then sort of thought about, well, kind of, is there an inherent reason for this, or sort of could it be simplified? And we sort of convinced ourselves that it probably could be simplified. And so kind of the idea we pitched each other on, and I still kind of have the old emails about this, is what if there was SliceHost, but for payments? And so that was basically how we described it to each other, SliceHost for payments. And actually, the original name for Stripe was not Stripe. It was /dev/payments. And so you can tell we were definitely not branding experts.
And so did you know you needed to be in San Francisco for this, or had you already moved?
Yeah, so we were actually in school in Boston at the time, both of us, myself and John. But we had spent time in San Francisco before. And I guess, like, whatever about the need to be in San Francisco or the Bay Area for sort of the media and tech company, I think for one, this is building infrastructure and tools for other companies and for other developers. There's actually sort of a really kind of hard to overstate value to being in the Bay Area and just kind of co-located with all of these companies, because, I mean, they're your customers, and the difference between being able to sort of hop across to their offices versus having to, you know, hop on a plane or just not being able to have the meeting, like, that's actually really big. And again, especially early on, as we were sort of trying to do product discovery and understand the needs of our users and understand the market, we were just so powerful to be able to literally go and visit them or have them over to our office or whatever, so that we can kind of iterate on the product more quickly. Now, one thing, I mean, this is kind of a separate point, but I sort of generally believe is that in the early days of a company, people are too focused on metrics, on sort of the quantitative data, and insufficiently focused on the qualitative data, of just kind of observing people and having kind of highly specific but also very high bandwidth feedback channels for their product and what it is that they're building. And because later, kind of just by virtue of the maybe scale, you kind of have to resort to these really coarse, broad metrics, like, is a user active or not? But in the early days, the interesting question is not whether they're active or not, but just literally, tangibly, what are they doing? What do they understand and not understand, and so forth? And so for us, being in the Bay Area was basically a way better, or it was being able to sort of answer those questions. And so I would say that, again, kind of moving from Boston to San Francisco was basically about expediting the product feedback cycle.
And you dropped out of college for this, or you never went to college?
So I went to school. I was a math major. My mom always insists that I did not drop out. I'm merely on leave. But yes, I think it is. I think it is very fair to say that I dropped out. And so I did about 2 years, and left in the summer of 2010.
And so you must have a ton of, you know, young entrepreneurs in college come up to you and say, hey, you know, I have this idea, I'm thinking of dropping out as well, or, you know, being on extended leave. What do you say to them?
So in general, I think that it's probably a bad idea, in that it's complicated, I guess. So first off, if you look at most people who drop out, it's generally that most companies fail. And I do think that college is sort of, for all its downsides, obviously kind of has a lot to recommend it. I mean, you can learn about stuff that's much harder to learn about outside of school. You're surrounded by really good people, and you don't have a lot of other commitments and responsibilities. You know, you have access to all kinds of opportunities. So there's a lot that's good about it. I do think that it's a very contingent question, that it really depends on what you're comparing it to. If you're comparing it to a company that's very clearly succeeding, and that you're confident is going to go somewhere, then yeah, maybe it makes sense. And so I think it's difficult to argue that Zuckerberg or Gates should not have sort of, well, I guess in both cases, dropped out of Harvard. But again, in the median case, when somebody's considering dropping out, they're normally not dropping out for something that sort of looks as promising as Facebook did in the summer of 2004. For something kind of much more speculative. So that's kind of the first point.
Did you have those metrics?
That's a good question. We had pretty promising data. We were not as far along as I understand Facebook was in 2004, but we had real users up and running. They loved the product, and we had this extremely long waiting list of people who wanted to use Stripe and were sort of desperately asking us for invitations. And so we weren't at any significant scale, but we did have a strong sense that we were kind of headed in the right direction. Just given the nature of the Stripe product, it was kind of pretty obvious to us that if it was good, it would be kind of a good business and monetizable and everything. Whereas I guess there were some other things where it might become really popular, but it's hard to know what exactly that's going to translate into. And the classic example here is kind of 4chan, where demonstrably super popular, still not to this day, kind of not clear what that translates into in terms of a business. And there are lots of other kind of online communities and social networks that have that to kind of varying degrees. So anyway, but just one other thing to kind of flag on the college point is maybe just a sort of broader societal and social point, and it kind of cuts both ways. On the one hand, I think college actually has these kind of really underestimated pernicious effects where it sort of encourages people to climb way too much. And I think to kind of take fewer risks, in that in order to kind of succeed in the world of college, you have to sort of do well in kindergarten and then in sort of K through 12 and high school, and to get score well in the SATs to get into college, you need to get a good GPA in college. And sort of you're constantly put through all these filters that really discourage risk taking. And so I think that's kind of bad in aggregate and has even more pernicious effects than is generally appreciated. But on the other hand, it's sort of it's difficult to know what you should do at an individual level, because you're just one person, you don't get to choose this world. And if so many of the opportunities in the world are restricted to those who graduate college, well, you can't fix that yourself. And so I think there's kind of both an individual question and a broader social question. And so I kind of both believe that college is way overrated and most individuals should go to college. And so it's kind of this weird duality.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Well, let's get to this broader point even deeper, and then we'll get back obviously to Core Stripe. If Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, Ev Williams, all the top founders of Silicon Valley said, we want our kids to have a different education. We want to create custom K through 12, custom university. And they said, Patrick, we want you to be in the brainstorming session. You don't have kids, but you have great ideas. We want you to put some thoughts together on what you would kind of design as, core principles of an ideal K through 12 or even, even higher education. How would you even begin to think about that?
Man, that's didn't quite come prepared with an answer to that question. And I definitely wouldn't claim to have great ideas, but I think it depends a lot on what you're optimizing for and who you're optimizing for, and that it's sort of often pointed out, and there's sort of a bunch of kind of seditious literature about education systems in the US and more broadly, and how they kind of serve this industrial revolution function of sort of turning people into automata. But, you can't dismiss all of that in the sense that, fine. Maybe you say that education should not serve sort of the childcare function, but you're still kind of then left with the question of, okay, what are we going to do about childcare? Because the entirety of our society is structured around the adults largely being at work, and so there are sort of these interdependent components that you need to kind of think about as a whole. Having said that, just from a kind of purely kind of learning and pedagogical standpoint, I think that, yes, school just isn't that effective, and there's all this kind of suggestive empirical data kind of looking at people with varying degrees of schooling and indeed varying degrees of college, and sort of to what degree that actually provides them with sort of broader cognitive abilities. And for example, the longitudinal data for people who go through college is that they do not tend to have better critical thinking skills post hoc, and that the argument made for sort of a liberal education is you gain these, just become better at thinking in general. It's not about knowing these specific authors or works, or whatever, although maybe there's some of that, but it's more about just you're a more effective person in the world. And the evidence really doesn't support that very strongly. But I guess to get back to your kind of question about sort of at the K through 12 level, I guess my rough sense is that you kind of want to flip the model from being much more about, it should be much more about pull rather than push. There's a very interesting, by which I mean sort of you want to provide the best resources to the students so that when they want to know something, they can sort of go from the state of not knowing to knowing it as easily as they can and as effectively as they can, rather than sort of being these battery chickens with sort of the curriculum being pushed down their throats.
Self-directed learning.
Yeah. And I think you still need to kind of provide, you need to aid their exploration, because people don't always know kind of where the most interesting concepts are and where the most interesting knowledge is. But yeah, roughly, I think you want to have it be more self-directed. And, you know, just a very interesting kind of anecdote I heard on this front is there's an interesting set of charter schools here in the Bay Area called Summit. And sort of they basically, well, in general, they're very kind of empirically driven. They kind of measure everything that they do. They're sort of pursuing things pretty rigorously. And they basically decided to kind of vary the balance between how many classes they had, what fraction of the day was spent with kids in class versus how much was kind of self-directed learning, and kind of looking at the outcomes there in terms of test scores. And they basically found that reducing the fraction of time spent in class had sort of the inverse correlation to test scores as compared to what you'd expect. Basically where they've ended up, as I understand it, is what they describe it as a sort of a genius bar-like model, where there are always teachers available, but sort of at the students' kind of request and as they need them, rather than sort of standing there lecturing. And so I don't know that that's necessarily the right model, but I think that's kind of a suggestive hint that being substantially more oriented around, again, pull rather than push, might be both kind of pedagogically more effective and just honestly way more fun.
No, definitely. Makes a lot of sense. Let's get deep into Stripe now. You guys have built a culture where developers love to use the product and also want to work with you, want to work for you and with you. How have, you know, what principles do you abide by when building that culture? To what do you credit that?
You mean sort of just the culture of Stripe in general?
Yeah, just why developers love it so much.
I don't think it's kind of reducible to any single thing. And kind of if it could be, then probably others would have copied it by now. I think there's a general, I think at a high level, first off, we just care about it more than other companies, in that it's part of the DNA of the company in the way that, I guess, sort of stereotypically design is at Apple, in that we're a company started by developers, we build for other developers, and our product is inherently sort of a service, again, that developers consume. And just those things aren't true of many other companies, in that other companies might have an API, or, I mean, obviously, if they're a technology company, they have some developers, but it's rarely as core and central in the same way. And so that's influenced kind of every aspect of Stripe, from the strategy to the marketing to the culture and sort of everything in between. And so again, I think it's more sort of an endless list of things that follow from that kind of high order aspect than there being kind of this particular sort of secret key that unlocks the whole thing. One way I sometimes kind of describe this to people in terms of getting at kind of the fundamental difference is that I think that in Silicon Valley, most of the companies are about building cars in some way, by which I mean they're about building a direct sort of consumer service in general. Obviously, there's many exceptions, but sort of in general. And even if it's not a consumer service, it's a service of some kind. Maybe it's even a business service. But they're building something analogous to a car that it is that they sell. Whereas in the case of Stripe, we're much more about building roads. We're about building the infrastructure and the tools and the kind of fabric that enables people to go and build other things. And so it's kind of one layer of removal. And that's just, I think, a very different mindset. Frankly, it sort of demands quite a bit more humility, because you are at one level of removal. You don't know exactly what people are going to build with it, and you're sort of dependent on them. You don't get to do the whole thing yourself. It's kind of like we're building paintbrushes instead of painting paintings. Some people just really want to be painters. I think that's actually a pretty substantial distinction. Now, as it happens, my personal belief is that, again, the Silicon Valley kind of talked a big game about the importance of software and technology. I don't think we really live that in practice. I think that, in general, be it in programming languages or in editors or in APIs or in tooling or in sort of any part of the software stack, I think we're still kind of living in the dark ages. And so in that sense, I think that being a company that's really kind of geared around making stuff better for developers, that's actually a generally a pretty important direction. And so, you know, even though I kind of use the analogy of making paintbrushes rather than painting paintings, I think there's actually a lot of innovation possible in the paintbrushes.
Right. But elaborate more on what you think of when you talked about the dark ages. What more do you want to see on the software side?
Yeah, I guess we could probably do a whole podcast on that. But if you look at a day in the life of a typical developer at any organization, and if you kind of think about what they're trying to do, and then if you look at kind of what they actually do, kind of you think about the high level goal, like maybe they're trying to build this feature, maybe they're trying to identify and fix this bug, maybe they're trying to explore some concept, kind of whatever that kind of high level goal is. And then if you look at sort of the set of tasks they need to perform in order to achieve that, it's just incredibly antiquated. There's kind of this very interesting and influential paper by J.C.R. Licklider entitled Man-Computer Symbiosis. And in it, he sort of describes having investigated what is it that scientists do. You know, we kind of talk a lot about the importance of science, but kind of what does it look like to do science? And, you know, a lot of it is kind of reading papers and looking at charts and investigating data and kind of so forth, right? And sort of, I mean, he was kind of one of the original thinkers of sort of the importance of computers, kind of motivated by sort of this direction in thinking about kind of what does it mean to do science and how could we make that more effective. And I think there's probably a similar kind of set of questions to be asked that just don't get asked a whole lot of what does it look like to do software development and what does the ideal version of that look like and what does it look like when we do it in practice today. And so I guess I would argue today that we're less than 10% as productive as we could be. There are so many stupid ways of doing things, you know, things that have way too much overhead or latency or whatever the case might be. You have to like SSH to this box and then run these tests and it takes 10 minutes and then deploy these changes and add some new debug statements and then kind of run this code in your head and try to understand why it's printing that thing and then upgrade this library but it's incompatible with this one, and just like you've wasted 2 days in order to just kind of diagnose a single bug rather than conceivably having this incredibly tight integration with your editor where you can maybe make a single change and it's kind of automatically integrated with your production environment. Or anyway, I'm kind of completely speculating here, but I guess this is what I'm getting at. It's not that there's like a specific thing broken, it's more that just kind of the high level task of doing development, of changing and developing software is so kind of vastly less efficient than it ought to be. And I think there's a whole lot of potential there. You know, obviously what Stripe is doing is kind of related to this, and that like this very specific part of software development, i.e. handling money, was kind of comically inefficient and we saw a lot of potential there. But you know, that this is a tiny fragment of the overall landscape, and I think in almost any part of it, there is just vast kind of strides to be made.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you brought up this, you know, paintbrush analogy, painter analogy. You guys are building brushes for kind of painters whose business models are changing, things like, you know, Kickstarter, Lyft, Instacart. How do you kind of prepare for business models that you can't necessarily foresee? You know, how do you work with that?
That's a really good question. So a couple things. First off, it's sort of about trying to build generalizable, flexible APIs so that even if we don't anticipate the use case, we can be sort of pleasantly surprised when people are able to take what we built and use it to really effectively, cleanly address that use case without us having foreseen it. And I think that kind of gets at this notion of a good tool is one which can be put to a use case for which it was not intended and still work really well for that use case. And so we try not to be overly prescriptive in the APIs that we build because, and again, it kind of gets back to this idea of humility. We know that we can't foresee everything in advance. So that's part of it, being kind of parsimonious and conservative in not over-specifying. The second part is trying to be very attentive to and receptive to ways in which people are kind of quote unquote trying to misuse the APIs that we build, and when people kind of ask us for weird things, really thinking carefully about what it is that they're actually saying and what the actual problem they're looking to solve is. Kind of an obvious example here is when we first launched Stripe, we got a ton of feature requests for account provisioning, which it's kind of a strange term, but people basically wanted a programmatic way to create Stripe accounts for other people. And, you know, that's super weird because kind of for what service do you want to, you know, programmatically create accounts for others? Like, Facebook isn't going to expose a programmatic way to create Facebook accounts for your friends, right? It's kind of weird. And we sort of dug into it and we kind of realized that what they were looking for is essentially a way to send money to other people. Like, that's actually sort of what it boiled down to. They were looking to sort of accept money in some way on behalf of others and have that money go to them. And there are kind of so many different ways in which a business model like that kind of manifests, be it Kickstarter, you know, really obviously, where they're sort of creating this network and platform that enables other people to have their projects funded, right through to Instacart or Lyft, where it's more about sort of drivers or, you know, delivery contractors or whatever kind of performing those tasks. But so it would have been really easy for us to dismiss the request for sort of account provisioning as a little bit outlandish and a bad idea, which it was, but the reason they were asking, the actual underlying need, was totally legitimate and kind of in hindsight, a huge market. And so it's sort of this kind of product thinking around what are people really trying to do that's kind of very, very critical. And again, just comes back to the disposition of the company. I think kind of you can do that when it's a company built by developers, serving developers, that just has that sort of deeply imbued in its foundations. So I think they're the main two things, kind of carefully factored APIs and then being attentive to the ostensible misuses. I'm trying to think if there's a third. I suppose then maybe the third is being fairly aggressive once you do understand the use case about building support for it, in that kind of once we realized we were trying to do with these kind of marketplace platform APIs to pay others, we then went to kind of a lot of effort to go and build great support for it, such that now the vast majority of this entire category is built on Stripe. We have a 5-person team of engineers just working on this specific, you know, part of our API. And so it doesn't happen incredibly often, but every now and again we'll kind of see a new use case that we think can be pretty significant or can kind of unlock a lot of new kinds of businesses. I think there's something about sort of having the conviction to go and actually build really good support when that happens.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talked about people using it to send money back and forth. It's still easier today to send information back and forth than it is to move money. You're from Ireland originally, so you're very conscious of borders, and the internet theoretically it is borderless. But kind of what are the key challenges Stripe faces as you guys try to facilitate global commerce?
It's a whole bunch of stuff. And kind of, as you point out, this has been sort of pretty close to our hearts from the beginning. Just not only were John and I from outside the US, but a very large fraction of the earliest people at Stripe were from outside the US. Like Ludwig, our first designer, was from Sweden. Billy, who's now our chief business officer, grew up in Honduras, kind of so forth. There's sort of a long list of folks here. Kind of the company always had this sort of global disposition, and we always kind of found it funny that people in the U.S. sort of talked about international as if it was kind of these faraway lands with kind of incomprehensible needs and desires and sort of product requirements. What makes it challenging for Stripe in particular is that banking infrastructure and kind of the money pipes in different countries are just different and have different APIs and work in different ways and require working with different partners. And so there's kind of this cornucopia of different systems that we have to handle and interact with. Secondly, that the regulations are different in all these countries. And so again, there's just kind of this linear increase in complexity with each additional market. And it's actually kind of a little bit worse because most of them are smaller than the US. Like the US is the second largest economy in the world, the first or the second. And so each additional country you're looking at supporting is kind of in general a smaller economy and adds kind of all this additional complexity. And so kind of the ROI, the kind of the additional market size you're gaining for each additional country is actually sort of decreasing. And so I think this is why so many US companies in particular find global expansion challenging. Whereas if you start out, say, in Ireland, all the other markets you might expand to are much larger. And so in some way, the ROI is actually increasing. And so, you know, there's kind of that dynamic at play. Having said that, we believe, I guess, that the analysis I sort of just described is actually kind of mistaken, because it sort of ignores the potential for what could happen. And something we often point out to people is that only about, I mean, it's a little bit difficult to measure, but only about 2 or 3% of total consumer spending, like globally, takes place on the internet today. The vast, vast, vast majority, 97, 98%, still kind of takes place in some kind of fundamentally offline way, which, you know, the real world is pretty big. But when you kind of think about what that number looks like for you, or for kind of your cohort, or maybe the city that you're in or whatever, there's a good chance it's much higher. And so there's kind of a huge amount of there's the famous William Gibson quote about the future being here, but not yet evenly distributed. I think that's kind of very true for business and commerce on the internet. And kind of from a global aspect, I think that there's a huge amount of commerce that could be taking place across borders, but isn't, because of just deficiencies and heterogeneity and inefficiencies and so forth in kind of the infrastructure that exists. And so I think kind of that analysis of looking at the existing market sizes is kind of mistaken, because what you have to be looking at is the potential market sizes. And there, I think kind of the ROI looks much better. And then secondly, I think you have to look at it in terms of the world as a whole, in that, you know, so much of the promise of the internet is kind of, as you point out, getting to sort of transcend physical geography and kind of obviating the restrictions of physical borders. And I think it's kind of incumbent on us as the infrastructure providers to help bring that about. The one thing that's kind of a saving grace is that there are only about 200 countries in the world. And so, yeah, it's really painful to have to go and add sort of specific support for each one, understand the local regulations, banking infrastructure, everything else. It's a lot of work, but it's not an infinite amount of work. It is actually a completable task. And so, you know, Stripe is now available to consumers pretty much anywhere you've a credit card, or indeed anywhere you've Bitcoin, because we support Bitcoin and a couple of other payment mechanisms. But we're kind of already available to consumers in many, many geographies. And we're available to businesses in about 25 countries, which, you know, means we're not yet available to businesses in 175. But, you know, it's not an infinite number. And so, just given the importance, we are willing to go country by country, market by market, until we address all 200 of them.
Kevin Kelly came on the podcast and talked about how, you know, people view nationalism the same way they view racism today. Like, you know, that it's not okay. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I would directionally agree with him, but disagree with him slightly. In general, I agree. I passionately hope that physical borders are of decreasing importance in the future. There's a kind of a project and a movement called Open Borders that Brian Kaplan and Alex Tabarrok and a number of others have been kind of vocal supporters, and I strongly endorse it. And it's kind of basically the idea that pretty much the single best policy change the world as a whole could make, the single best contributor to global progress, GDP growth, just welfare of humanity, would be to open immigration to everyone. Because there are so many people being held back in so much of the world by being kind of restricted to stay where they are, where they could be somewhere else, where they'd be sort of able to contribute more. And that's kind of, on some level, such an unethical thing to do. Like, if you imagine defending to an alien that we've all these kind of randomly kind of historically informed separations on top of the atoms that make up the world's landmass, and that we've this sort of incredible apparatus for restricting who can go where based on the soil upon which they happen to have been born. Like, it just seems so incredibly sort of archaic when you sort of think about it in the abstract. So, in that sense, there's been really good research on this. Danny Roddick at Harvard has sort of, you know, analyzed the lightly gaining wages from immigrants who come to the country versus sort of the potential downsides in terms of, like, you could argue that maybe just people in a particular market have a preference, but sort of you really have to have an incredibly strong aversion to immigrants for kind of the economics to work out, such that it's kind of not welfare improving to have more people, you know, enter a country or a region. Anyway, so I really agree with the open borders case. I am, as a citizen of the world, I am embarrassed by the kind of collective restrictions that we impose on humanity. Having said that, kind of to Kevin Kelly's point about it hopefully becoming as sort of unacceptable as racism, there are attributes that collective groups of people can have, in the sense that I think that people from Ireland have some differences to in terms of the culture, not in terms of their intrinsic abilities, just in terms of the culture, as compared to people from Silicon Valley or people from Japan tend to have a different culture to people from Germany. And, you know, this is obviously the most obvious thing to assert in the world. And this doesn't just go for nationalities. This goes for sort of any way in which you might group people.
Religion, young people, certainly.
Young people tend to have different beliefs and affinities to old people in general. Young people in specific cities will have different affinities and preferences to young people in other cities. And so, you know, I think this being descriptive about those collectives is not an unacceptable thing to do, but to kind of go the reverse direction, to be prescriptive or to be normative, you should be kind of much more careful. And so anyway, I think that sort of racism gets at a kind of historical baggage and kind of insane injustices that have been wrought in the past, and also sort of unscientific and discredited arguments about sort of different capabilities or intrinsic differences between different races, which are just not true. And so I think that to kind of talk about cultural differences is not on the same level as talking about discredited science. And so in that sense, I don't completely agree with Kevin Kelly, but I'm fully in support of the general direction.
You've obviously spoken a lot about immigration. You've written a lot about it. Are you optimistic about where immigration policy is going?
In the U.S.?
Yes.
No. I'm generally mostly optimistic about the long term on most things, in that humanity has done okay to date. But yeah, I don't see how you could look at the last 20 years and be really anyway optimistic about substantial progress being made over the next 20. In fact, I think in some ways you might be more pessimistic, because at least 20 years ago we hadn't had the sort of demonstrated failure that we've now had for the intervening 20 years, whereas we've basically spent the last 10, 20 years haranguing and kind of observing the sort of insanities of the immigration system and the sort of mistakes being made, and we've kind of now demonstrated our inability to do a whole lot about it. And so you know, you can maybe make some cases for there being glimmers of hope on the horizon, but I would certainly not say that I'm optimistic.
Do you foresee yourself getting involved at all in government or politics, even from a very outside role?
Stripe takes up way, way, way too much of my time. nor, like you said, am I a citizen, which also curtails things somewhat, but I am focused about 110% on Stripe.
Right. I guess my broader question to that is, are you a believer of the, you know, when your friends in Silicon Valley are organizing and trying to make efforts to improve immigration policy, do you believe that, you know, substantial change happens through through policy, or do you prefer to, you know, for people to do things in the private sector?
I think you have to be pretty realistic about what the private sector or what the kind of non-governmental sector can do, in that, like, I'm as big a believer as anyone in sort of the capabilities of technology and of sort of more broadly kind of motivated groups of sort of affect change in the world. But there are some things where sort of it can only be government. And I guess I don't really subscribe to or even particularly identify with some of the strain in Silicon Valley of sort of this utopianism around our ability to affect any change that we want in the world, or to kind of succeed from society, or sort of whatever the case might be. I think that's kind of unrealistic. And so, for better or worse, we're kind of in this one together. And if we want to make progress on immigration, we do have to fix it at the level of the institutions we've built in our society, and I don't think there's a clever buffer overflow hack that gets around that.
What book do you find yourself most gifting or recommending, and why?
Oh man, I'm not sure this is necessarily the kind of literal answer, in that I'm not sure which book I actually end up recommending most, but one I find myself recommending a lot is The Dream Machine by Mitchell Waldrop. It's basically a kind of history of the very early computer and technology and kind of nascent internet industries and sort of thinking behind them and how so much of what we are all using today sort of came into existence. And I think that it's something that people think they kind of understand and very few people actually do. There was sort of a lot of very kind of provocative, interesting, and kind of for the time, creative and ambitious visions behind, again, computers and the internet, and I think they're kind of underappreciated by the industry. And so I think Waldrop did a really nice job of capturing it in that book. And so just kind of given the sort of people that I get to interact with being here in San Francisco, I find myself referencing it a whole lot.
When you think of the term success, who's the first person that comes to mind and why?
It's so hard to answer that question kind of in the abstract. And it's so kind of contextual, right? I mean, business success, humanitarian success, kind of academic success, success in the realm of ideas and sort of improving our sort of collective human understanding. And the question when you ask kind of who do I think of when you think of successful people, I probably first go towards people who've been successful in business because I think that that's, for better or worse, and I think probably worse, what society tends to value most, at least kind of here in the U.S. That's obviously kind of more a cultural statement perhaps than a personal one. And also, I suppose, I have just kind of a personal bias towards the ones who are kind of underappreciated, in that, you know, even in our own industry, for example, I think Bob Noyce is such an incredible genius, and yet so few people sort of know a whole lot of the history or the background there. Like, not only was he sort of responsible for the creation of one of the most successful and enduring technology companies in the world, in Intel, but he's done so much to kind of define the broader culture that came to characterize Silicon Valley in terms of the kind of respect given to engineering, in terms of the kind of lack of pretense and the kind of just the lack of hierarchy and kind of ostentation that was so characteristic of sort of the stereotype of East Coast business. That's such a vast degree of accomplishment that sort of none of us could possibly aspire to. And yet, I think sort of substantially under-recognized in our industry. And so I suppose, again, just personally, I have a bias towards towards those kinds of success stories rather than the, I mean, not that Bill Gates hasn't accomplished immense things. He of course has, but I think the world kind of understands that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Most operators at the top level don't have like hundreds of book recommendations aren't like tweeting with Tyler Cowen and Evan Osnos and kind of a lot of, you know, thinkers and academic and in media world. Why do you think that is? Are operators just too busy, or are you an outlier, or am I incorrect in that assumption?
And maybe it's just that I use Twitter more, and so it's more visible for me. But it could also be that, I'm being kind of honest here, like I don't have a whole lot of other commitments. Like I live a block from the office. I'm at the office sort of 12, 13 hours a day, and then I get home and I read a bit. I don't have kids. I guess I'm just sort of at a life stage where some of that sort of lifestyle is possible in a way that it isn't necessarily for everyone. And so, yeah, basically, I don't think it's that I'm necessarily more interested in ideas or books or this thinking or whatever, but perhaps I'm just in the incredibly fortunate position where I get to sort of spend more time on it. I think that in general, sort of thinking in other fields and historical knowledge and thinking are both kind of, again, underappreciated in our field and industry, in that, you know, part of what's so great about Silicon Valley is the kind of naive optimism, in a sense, where sort of even without knowing all the details and the historical context and the prior art and so forth, we can just go and reinvent something and it'll be great. And what's so powerful about that thinking is it sometimes works. And yet I think that there's kind of a slight cost to it, where sometimes we spin our wheels a bit. And, you know the famous Alan Kay quote about computer science being like pop culture, in the sense of kind of pop culture doesn't have a direction. It's just kind of, it's this haphazard Brownian motion through culture space. Whereas there are other cultures, most obviously science, but even potentially kind of classical art or classical music and so forth, where there's kind of a slightly clearer kind of ideological progression. you know, I think Silicon Valley kind of misses out on some of that. And so be it kind of physics or economics or fiction or whatever, I think that there's kind of a lot of ideas that you can kind of productively draw on in these other fields. And I mean, maybe this is somewhat specific to Stripe, because again, we're sort of a tool and an infrastructure company. And so perhaps the Stripe problem space is more kind of amenable to sort of deliberate thinking in a way that consumer apps aren't. Maybe consumer apps are just kind of a bit more just inherently random, and there's not a whole lot of kind of higher level thinking that you can bring to bear on them. It's more about just sort of your general taste. I don't know. That's I guess my open-ended speculation.
Perhaps there should be a book club that you host on, you know, fiction 1 month and economics another month, and kind of diversity.
Maybe I read more than most people in Silicon Valley, but in the scheme of things, I am not well read. I would feel not remotely qualified to possibly lead a book club. I'm just sort of tinkering a little bit, kind of on the side in, you know, the hour before I go to sleep. But having said that, if someone else did that, I would probably love to follow along. And actually, the other people who tend to read a lot or be kind of particularly interesting sort of thinkers or sources of interesting work, I mean, those are I hugely appreciate their work. And so, be it folks like Scott Alexander over at Slate Star Codex, or Mark Andreessen is obviously really good at this, or Tyler Cohen and so forth. I think they they're among the internet personalities I most appreciate for the kind of the diversity of the ideas that they surface.
Mm-hmm. And their aggregating prolificness.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Pat. I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for coming on the Product Hunt podcast. Lastly, you know, there are a lot of developers listening, a lot of entrepreneurs. Do you have any plugs for what's upcoming at Stripe, what we can expect? And if you have an ask of our audience, feel free to ask as well.
Can't talk about our future product, even though there's a bunch of things that we're sort of polishing or getting ready to launch or talk about that I'm really excited about. Having said that, I always love hearing feedback from either Stripe users or developers, and I don't just mean that as some kind of generic platitude. I mean, I literally read the emails, I try to respond to as many as I can, and it's really informative and influential in kind of determining our product roadmap. I mean, like, we are building for people like ourselves, and it's really useful to kind of to hear from the front lines. And so my email address is patrick@stripe.com. And if anyone is, if any listener is either using Stripe or considering it or decided they couldn't for some reason or whatever, just kind of has opinions on the Stripe product, I would hugely appreciate hearing from them. And so, yeah, please feel free to drop me a note anytime.
Excellent, Patrick. Love what you guys are doing. Thank you so much for coming on the Product Hunt podcast.
Thanks for having me.